If you spend any time around Klamath Falls, you get used to hearing the rumble of fighter jets. The F-15s of the Oregon Air National Guard use Kingsley Field as a base and the skies over Oregon as a place to train. But exactly where the planes can make their training flights is very clearly outlined on maps, and the jets are supposed to stay within those zones. The Guard wants the zones bigger, for reasons we'll get into, and the request comes with a pile of paperwork in the format of an environmental impact statement recently released in its final form, the FEIS you'll hear described. Let's hear about the bigger zones and their effects. We have two guests. On the phone is Brigadier General Jeffrey Silver, who is the commander of the Oregon Air National Guard. General, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Good morning.
Good to have you here. And Bob Skinner is with us as well in the studio. He is the owner of Skinner Aviation, which is the fixed-based operator which operates Ashland Municipal Airport, therefore has some knowledge of civil aviation as well. Bob Skinner, thank you for joining us.
You're more than welcome, Jeffrey.
So, General Silver, let's start with you and give us the real basics. What are the Air National Guard units for?
Well, we have two fighter wings in Oregon, the 142nd Fighter Wing up in Portland. Is a combat-ready squadron that trains and conducts operational missions, one of those being air defense for the Northwest. The wing in Klamath Falls, the 173rd Fighter Wing, is the single-source training wing for all F-15C pilots for both the U.S. Air Force and the Air National Guard. So a pretty big mission. A training wing versus an operational wing at Portland.
So everybody who knows how to operate an F-15 is going to have spent some time in Klamath Falls?
That's correct.
Okay, so how often the training must be pretty much nonstop, and how many hours is any individual pilot going to spend in training exercises when they're based at Kingsley?
So we train various levels of experience. Some folks that have flown the F-15 in the past and maybe went to a staff job and have to get requalified, all the way down to your kid that just came out of pilot training and is new to fighter aircraft and the F-15C in particular. That student spends about 6 months and flies roughly 65 hours in the airplane, plus quite a bit of simulator time.
All right, so obviously a lot of time you need to have with people aloft, and in some of these, are they simulating combat in the air?
Oh, absolutely. There's the initial phase is just learning how to take off and land and fly formation, the basics. So what we call advanced handling, learning to push the airplane, and then shortly after that, within a month of arrival at Klamath Falls, the students are learning how to dogfight and use the radar to conduct tactical operations.
Okay, so we'll get into a little further into the details of the training. I want to come to Bob Skinner and talk about civilian aviation and how it relates to all this. Skinner Aviation is the FBO, the fixed base operator at the Ashland Airport. Meanings what?
We provide all the aviation services for general aviation on the Ashland Airport.
So with those services would include what?
Well, we provide pilot training for general aviation, aircraft rental. We provide fuel sales. We also provide maintenance and parts for aircraft, and we also provide charter services.
So all the basic airport kinds of things come through your company?
Correct.
So are these generally completely different worlds, general aviation and military? Is there very little interaction between them?
Well, actually, that's a lot of the reason for these military operations areas is that we stay out of their way. And there's several of them around the state of Oregon. The biggest thing is education for the general aviation pilots, you know, knowing that they're there, which they all have the maps. But whether they're listening to their NOTAMs on a daily basis or not, you know, whether or not they know that the areas are in operation.
So it really is incumbent on any pilot to know that these zones are out there and make sure they stay out of them?
The pilots know that the zones are there. It's the pilot's responsibility to make sure that they know where they're at and avoid them, especially when they're active or hot.
We're talking about military aircraft training zones over the state of Oregon and a potential expansion of those now that there is a final environmental impact statement. Bob Skinner can talk about the general aviation part of things. He operates Skinner Aviation, which operates Ashland Municipal Airport. Brigadier General Jeffrey Silver is with us as well. He's the commander of the Oregon Air National Guard. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. General Silver, how long ago were the boundaries for the training zones set up? And we are talking two different kinds, but how long have they existed?
Well, if you're talking about the part that isn't being expanded, boy, I can't tell you exactly, but probably back to the 60s and 70s.
All right, so good set decades anyway. They've been up there for a long time. So what is the push then? What's the impetus for change here?
There's several reasons. I'll start with the 142nd Fighter Wing. Typical, and I flew there for over 20 years, and so I'm very familiar with the airspaces that we use. We typically try to do our training off the coast in what's called a warning area, Whiskey 570, directly west of Portland, pretty good airspace, and out of the way of most people that other users of the national airspace system. The problem with Whiskey 570 is because it's over the ocean, as we know how stormy it gets in the Northwest, there are limits to winds and sea states that we're allowed to fly over for safety reasons. So a lot of the time, especially in the winter, we're unable to use that those warning areas, and we need to find overland airspace to use. So there was an efficiency issue. To find airspace to do the training that's required for us to maintain combat readiness was one of the pushes to gain some more overland airspace, particularly the Red Hawk MOA, which is north-northeast of Bend, kind of between Bend and Pendleton.
And here's where we start getting into some of the acronyms. MOA is MOA for Military Operations Area?
Yes, that's right, and I apologize for that. I'll try to make sure I'm explanatory. A MOA is airspace that goes potentially from the surface. The lower altitudes vary, but they go up to no higher than 18,000 feet. Above 18,000 feet, military special use airspace is known as a ATCA, Air Traffic Control Airspace Area.
Okay. So MOA and ATCA. So ATCA is just a higher up sort of thing?
A firm, and it is in an area that most general aviation airplanes don't fly in, although some do, because it has higher requirements for radio equipment and navigation. It's where most of the commercial airliners fly.
All right. So how often are you kept out of that W570 zone off the coast west of Astoria?
I researched that a little bit over, let's call it a 12-month period. It's about 23-25% of the time, so about a quarter of the time we're unable to use that airspace.
Okay.
But
well,
during some months of the year, more often in the winter, it can be as much as three-quarters of the time we're unable to use that airspace.
Okay, so there are long stretches when you just don't get to use that airspace. So you're looking for an overland area. So as I look at the map here, there are a couple of – there's the Dolphin MOA on the southern Oregon coast, in addition to W-570 on the northern Oregon coast, and a couple of inland areas generally far east of the Cascades. So this brings us back to Bob Skinner and general aviation. It looks like when you fly from Ashland or Medford to anywhere in the I-5 corridor in the state of Oregon, it's never an issue.
Not on the west side so much. It's more the east side. And now with new technology and GPS navigation and the cost of fuel, everybody wants to go as straight line as possible wherever they're going. If you're going east, you're going to run into MOAs. And so many pilots may consider it an inconvenience, but actually it's well-designated areas that does allow the military to operate without the issues of having some general aviation pilot wander into their huge descents and climbs and the high speeds that they're operating at. They have equipment on board that can see us somewhat, but at the speeds that they're traveling, the closure rates can be, you know, astronomical as far as a few seconds, you know, from being able to see a person and then before you could be in their area.
So from first awareness to closing speed, it's a pretty fast thing.
It's extremely fast.
Mm-hmm. We have a call here from Harry in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about National Guard air training zones with Bob Skinner and Brigadier General Jeffrey Silver.
Please, and thank you very much. The question... immediate one is the privatization, potential privatization of one of our most needed services from the government, and that's air traffic controllers. Please, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, appreciate that, Harry. Has that come into the discussion at all up to this point, General Silver?
No, surely that's been in the mix for a while, but I just read an article the other day that President Trump is considering that. Privatization would, I think it would be somewhat transparent to the military. We don't care who directs us or controls us when we get to our military operating areas or ATCAs. We're independent of the FAA until we are ready to return to base.
All right. So once you're in a training area, you are working under military aviation control?
That's right. And there are times when the airspace is released to us and we actually are, we call it being autonomous, basically. There is no controller watching over us. And we're responsible for maintaining the ourselves within the airspace.
Okay. General, when I look at the zones where military training exercises take place, I mean, I don't see any communities of any real size within the zones, and I have to believe they are chosen for just that reason.
That's true. In particular, we designed a new military operating area and some ATCA airspace, the Red Hawk MOA, which is the one I talked about between Bend and Pendleton, primarily for that reason, to have the we needed more overland airspace. That was the place where the Oregon Air Guard, the Air Force, and the Federal Aviation Administration felt that there would be the least impact to civilians and other users of the airspace.
Are the military operations areas and the air traffic control assigned airspaces, the ATCAs, are those constantly turned on? I mean, are there times when a pilot in general aviation could fly through because there's no training going on, or is it an always on thing?
That's a great question. They are not always being used, and they're we call it activating the airspace by notice to airmen, as Bob talked about. Take the Juniper Hart airspace, for example. The 173rd Fighter Wing uses that airspace for maybe as much as 5 hours per day in two chunks. And so we'll activate the airspace in the morning for a couple of hours and in the afternoon for a couple of hours, usually. The rest of the time, the airspace is not being used. And oh, by the way, we have a bit of a unique situation in Oregon. The Oregon Air National Guard is really the only users of the airspace that we have. In other states, especially on the East Coast, the airspace is often scheduled day and night because there are so many users and it's so compacted out there.
So, Bob, if, for example, somebody wants to fly from, say, Ashland to Pendleton, they'd probably hit a little corner, the north corner of the Juniper MOA, military operations area. So would they take their schedule to determine when they could manage to miss when that zone is active, or
it's actually,
just plan around it?
Actually, just a little deviation in course. Mm-hmm. Typically, if you're in contact with ATC, air traffic control, they're going to warn you when you're getting close to an area. They'll also advise you whether or not what we consider the area to be hot or cold. And so you can make your flight plan and direction of flight, you know, dependent on that. It's usually just deviation, a few degrees, 10, 15 degrees one direction for a period of time, and then you can make a turn on course at that point. It's a little bit inconvenience, but actually for what they're designed for and the navigation technical GPS capabilities people have nowadays, it's quite an easy thing.
Do you have any chats with pilots who are expressing any concerns about this, or are they just pretty much like, hey, this is fine?
Well, living in the area we do, and anybody flying east, you know, from the Southern Oregon area, we're all pretty used to this. You know, the best thing the Air National Guard can do is they can get posters and media out to the airports around the area. There's not a high percentage of people that always go and check the NOTAMs when they go flying, and so they might just hop in their airplane and go flying and have in the direction that they're going. So if you have things that we can post in our FBOs that show the areas, it's just a visual reminder for the pilots, and it's an educational process that helps them gain the knowledge they need.
So General Silver, have you taken that step in making sure that that everybody is informed in pretty much any avenue possible?
I think that there is room for us to improve there. I'm taking that down as a note because it's pretty easy for us to do. You know, we have more in the local area gone out and talked to folks, but I think it's one of those things that requires constant engagement as pilots come and go from the system. And so thanks. That's a really good idea, Bob.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We have talked, General Silver, about the need for new areas, and so this Red Hawk MOA, if you draw a line between Bend and Pendleton, and it's right smack in the middle of that in the desert, the high desert there. But you're also talking about expanding some of the other existing zones, aren't you, General?
Yes, absolutely. And airspace that you have to fly through going east from southern Oregon is called Juniper and Hart. There's actually two airspaces that are abutted up against each other. We are trying to expand that out to the east approximately 20 miles or so to get a little bit more volume of airspace. This is mainly driven by an increase in training over the last few years as Kingsley Field, the 173rd Fighter Wing, took over the sole responsibilities for F-15 training. Also, another reason why we need more volume is that tactics evolve and weapons have longer ranges, and so you just need more space to do the current training than we did even 10 years ago.
As fast as those F-15s can fly, I would imagine you would get across, because if people look at the Juniper Hart on a map, it's fairly narrow east and west, and you could probably get across that in a jet in just a matter of minutes, I'm thinking.
Yes, absolutely. I want to say it's about 45 miles wide, so this would give us 65 miles. The tactics can split you. Basically, an F-15 subsonic goes about 9 miles per minute, so in 3 or 4 minutes you can be across the airspace completely. We also, our formations have gotten wider over the years, and typically a standard tactical employment method is to have 4 airplanes line abreast as much as 5 miles apart. So you could have a 20-mile-wide swath before you even do any maneuvering.
We're talking about the expansion of air training areas for the Air National Guard in Oregon with Brigadier General Jeffrey Silver, who is the Oregon Air National Guard commander. Bob Skinner is the owner of Skinner Aviation, which is the operator of the Ashland Municipal Airport. So he's talking to us about the civilian aviation viewpoint on things. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we mentioned at the top there's a final environmental impact statement, or FEIS, out on this. So this is required, obviously, to go through NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act process, General.
Yes, absolutely. And the entire process of trying to chart a new airspace for the military is pretty arduous. It first has to go through a pretty significant vetting process, which is eventually signed by the Secretary of the Air Force. The Air Force, or in this case, the Oregon Air National Guard, has to prove that they actually have a valid requirement and that there's no other better alternative solution. And so we've been through that entire process with the Air Force. Once that is vetted and the Secretary of the Air Force says, I think this is valid, go ahead and press forward, you then go into the environmental process, which can, if it's negative, can actually shut down the whole thing right then and there. We've reached so we've been doing the Environmental Impact Statement Act for about, 4 or 5 years, and this open public comment period signifies basically the end of the process. We've come up with the final version of the Environmental Impact Statement, and it's one last chance for the public and any other, say, federal agencies to weigh in on the responses and the conclusions of the environmental impact statement.
There's always a comment period, certainly after the draft environmental impact statement, the DEIS, before it becomes an FEIS, a final environmental impact statement. Did you get a lot of comment on the DEIS?
We got a I wouldn't call it a lot, and I guess you would have to compare that to what other environmental impact statements have seen. When you talk about the environmental piece, there's two pieces to any airspace action. There's what they call the aeronautical proposal, which is how does this affect users, and then there's the environmental piece. Environmental, there was some concerns about some birds, the greater sage grouse, and then greater sage grouse, and the golden eagle, also the Malheur Wildlife Refuge out near the Steens Mountains, which this airspace potentially could have impacted. Those were addressed very early on and mitigated, basically. For example, we changed the airspace slightly to avoid the Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
And so you actually tailored the boundaries just a bit?
Yes. Other issues are noise, and people are worried about pollutants, all of which were assessed and deemed to be insignificant.
All right. I noticed, too, that beyond this document, you have some glider clubs you need to make some deals with separately. Is that in far eastern Oregon? Or?
Yes, actually, maybe Bob knows better, there's a gathering and a competition out by the Steens Mountains every year of glider pilots. Also, some of those gliders are capable of flying very long distances at high altitudes, and so it's pretty important for us. The EIS discusses some mitigation efforts, such as memorandums of understanding between those organizations and the 173rd Fighter Wing, and an awareness campaign to make sure glider pilots know that when and if they are flying near military activity and especially use airspace.
All right. So, Bob, from the civilian perspective, other than issues like that where the gliders operate, is it pretty much just a no-brainer, no particular big issue for civilian folks?
It's just education. You know, it's knowing when and where to fly. With gliders, they're a little less opportune because they don't have an engine, so they have to rely on thermals and where they're going, and it would be education on their part also. It's just a matter of knowing when the areas are hot and to avoid them at that point, or to make coordination to where they're going to fly in there at times when they're not actively engaged with military operations.
So General Silver, last question before we go. People have a chance to comment until June 19th, is that right?
Yes, affirmative, and if anybody wants more information on this, there are two websites, one for the 142nd Fighter Wing, another for the 173rd Fighter Wing. We've placed a bunch of information on there concerning the environmental impact statement and why and how action will take. I encourage anybody that go and review that and your comments. You know, our goal is to be, we want to be good stewards of the nation's resources. We're taxpayers using taxpayer money to conduct. Want to be efficient, but we also are sensitive to the needs of other nations. So,
okay, General Jeffrey Silver, Bob Skinner, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're welcome.